You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of January 2015 on Monocle 24. And welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. Coming up on today's show,
Our counterterrorism cooperation with France is excellent. We will provide them with every bit of assistance that we can going forward.
The US President Barack Obama promising counterterrorism help to France. Meanwhile, the hunt for the two gunmen still at large after yesterday's shooting in Paris continues. My studio guests will discuss how all of this might impact security in the wider Eurozone. And a little later in the programme.
I'm always concerned about, more than anything else, the waste of human potential. That's the thing that upsets me, the waste of intelligence. And so much intelligence is wasted from poverty.
Roxy Music, ambient sounds and destroying poverty. It's all in a day's work for one of the UK's most respected musical legends. I talk, of course, of Brian Eno. Plus, we get the latest releases from the world of books, courtesy of Charmaine Lovegrove. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. But before all that, let's get the latest news from around the world. Here's James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. French anti-terrorism police have converged on an area northeast of Paris after two brothers, suspected of being behind an attack on a satirical newspaper, were spotted at a petrol station in the region. France's prime minister said he feared the Islamist militants, who killed 12 people, could strike again as a manhunt for two men widened across the country. Two police sources said that the men were seen armed and wearing cagoules in a Renault Clio car at a petrol station on a secondary road in Villers-Cotterêts, some 70 kilometres from the French capital. In other developments, a policewoman was killed in a shootout in Paris earlier today, but sources could not immediately confirm a link with Wednesday's killings at the Charlie Hebdo weekly newspaper that marked the worst attack on French soil for decades. National leaders have described the assault on Charlie Hebdo as an assault on democracy. Many European newspapers either republished Charlie Hebdo cartoons or mocked the killers with images of their own. Vigils have been held around the world in honour of the victims, and there's been continued international condemnation of the attack. British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond set out what risks were involved with taking on militant Islamists.
The events that have taken place in France over the last 24 hours, and we all express our solidarity with the French people and our determination to stand together in the face of terrorist threat and terrorist attack, they merely serve to remind us why we have taken on the challenge of Islamist extremism time and again in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, and now also in some of the African countries as well.
The London imam, Abu Hamza al-Masri, is scheduled to be sentenced on Friday by a federal judge in New York. US prosecutors have urged the judge to sentence Abu Hamza to life in prison following his conviction on terrorism charges. In a court filing ahead of his sentencing, prosecutors said Abu Hamza should be held accountable for his role as a global terrorist leader. The prosecuting US attorney is Preet Bharara.
Abu Hamza, as the trial showed, attempted to portray himself as a preacher of faith, but he was instead a trainer of terrorists. That has now been proven in an American court to a unanimous jury beyond a reasonable doubt.
Indonesia's National Search and Rescue Agency says strong underwater currents are making it impossible to confirm whether the flight recorders from AirAsia flight QZ8501 are still in place. The recorders are in the rear section of the Airbus, whose tail has been found on the seabed about 20 miles from the plane's last known location. And the former head of the Indonesian Air Force has said that corruption and overcrowded airspace were partly responsible for the crash. Air Chief Marshal Chappi Hakim was answering journalist questions on the disruption of communications between the pilot and air traffic control.
As you said, maybe the first thing is the weather condition, and the other thing we don't know yet, but I believe the traffic is contributed with this accident, and certainly the management of the airspace in the very crowded area maybe contributed as well.
Nigeria's President Goodluck Jonathan has today opened his campaign to win a second elected term, defending his record on the Boko Haram insurgency and corruption to a rally of thousands in the opposition stronghold of Lagos. Mr. Jonathan faces opposition candidate Muhammadu Buhari, a former military ruler who was seen as tough on crime, militancy and corruption in a February the 14th election that correspondents say is too close to call. And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
It's 18.06 here in London, 13.06 in New York. There is but one story dominating the headlines. It is the aftermath of the shootings at Charlie Hebdo, the satirical magazine in Paris yesterday. Joining me now with their take on the developments here in the studio, I'm delighted to say that Shashank Joshi from the Royal United Services Institute, where he is a senior research fellow here in London, and George Brock, who is Professor of Journalism at City University in London, joins me both to talk about today's news. And we stick with Paris, where two suspects are still on the run after 12 people were gunned down at the headquarters of Charlie Hebdo yesterday. They robbed a petrol station in northeast France today, and the suspects have been seen in a Renault Clio carrying Islamist flags and Molotov cocktails. The gunmen, Shashank, don't seem to be too worried about the fact that people know where they are and what they're doing.
No, they are heavily armed. I think they are banking on the fact that they're on the move, that the police can't shut off every road in France, and that they've been able to secure food and supplies and provisions. What worries me here is that although they were not suicidal in their first mission, the nature of what they're carrying, the nature of what they were saying, the way the net will inevitably close in around them, suggests they will go out with some sort of big and probably very destructive finish.
So, George, would you agree that they are perhaps hankering after the ultimate glorious battle played out across every news outlet in France, indeed the world?
I'm sure that Shashank is right. I'm sure they're looking for a shootout. If the police are really smart, they're not always perfect in these situations, panicked as they are likely to be. They will be very careful, I would have thought, before they start trying to shoot at them. We may be accustomed to the sight of policemen with guns nowadays, but actually, the number of policemen in any Western country who actually have guns and really know how to use them is relatively quite small. So concentrate less on the numbers of policemen who are supposed to be out there and think more about how many people they actually got on the ground in the right place who would actually be able, possibly, to arrest or possibly shoot these people.
It is funny because you mentioned the general absence of arms across most of the Western capitals, but actually I would always argue that the CRS in France has a very, very heavy presence, especially at large gatherings. But they don't always get the impression that they would know how to employ their weapons effectively.
There's more of a tradition of paramilitary policing in France because France is a country with a very long history of being extremely nervous about public disorder. But nevertheless, the number of policemen in any European country who really know how to use firearms in difficult situations, and people were very quick to point out that these people who attacked Charlie Hebdo yesterday have done this before. They weren't firing guns for the first time in their lives. It seems very unlikely. So they're probably ready for what comes, and they probably don't think they can get out of France.
George, just mentioning there the idea that these men knew how to use their weapons, Shashank, much has been said in the press. All media outlets have noted that they went into the offices of Charlie Hebdo with incredible professionalism. They knew exactly who they were targeting. They seemed to know exactly when to go into the office to make sure that everybody there, it was production week, they were having their meetings in the office. But to what degree do you actually think that this professionalism of which everyone speaks is as of higher degree as people are speculating?
I think we have to be careful to strike a balance here. We've experienced 6 or so months of very amateurish attacks, people with small firearms, entirely on their own, with no support network, in many cases utterly incompetent. We saw the Sydney siege. Before that, we saw the attack on Canada's Parliament building. We saw people driving cars into pedestrians in France. This I think, primed us to look at any use of assault rifles in a coordinated way as being highly sophisticated. Now, they did have specialized equipment. They do appear to be carrying rocket launchers, according to multiple reports. And indeed, they did know where they were going. But also, let's remember here, they crashed their escape car into a bollard. They left their ID in that vehicle. They initially went into the wrong building. So in a number of ways, they have also made mistakes. And if you look closely at their tactics and firearm use, they were not highly militarily trained. They overlapped each other's paths. Their field of fire was not always up to professional standards. So yes, it is more sophisticated, but is it on the scale of a Mumbai attack? Absolutely not.
So are we looking, George, in the context of what Shashank has just said, at a situation of two men having experienced either direct conflict or indeed some advanced degree of training, perhaps in Syria, perhaps in Iraq, fulfilling all the warnings that have been made in the last 3 or 4 months of these men leaving Western countries and getting a taste of jihad?
Well, I'd better say to start with, we have no idea about these two. But if you're asking about the odds that they are people who've been in Syria or somewhere similar, well, it's possible. There are supposed to have been, best estimates seem to be, 1,000 French citizens, which is a very large number, larger than those from Britain, who've gone out to that war, that civil war. It's possible that that's where they got some practice. But I'm sure that Shashank is also right in observing that they're not, you know, they're hardly highly trained. It just looks like they've done a bit of this before. And it seems to me like they're anticipating, as you said at the beginning, a shootout at the end.
I think while we don't know precisely whether they're affiliated to any group or which one, there now are two eyewitness reports. First of all, at the point of entry into the building, where they said, "We are Al-Qaeda." And second of all, at the point of the second carjacking, when they carjacked their second escape vehicle, where they said, "We are from Al-Qaeda in Yemen." Of course, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, is Al-Qaeda's most operationally potent branch. The interesting thing is, it's in the last 5 or 6 years been very successful, but only at putting very good bombs onto Western-bound aircraft. It hasn't really gone in for these kind of gun raids. So is it a change of tactic, or are these people simply appropriating the name? Well, too early to say.
Are we perhaps appropriating a cause to something which at the moment we're not exactly entirely sure of?
Well, I mean, all we have to go on, of course, are the fact that they picked that very specific target carefully, and they were shouting, "We have avenged the Prophet," by other eyewitness accounts, which I think are now accepted as being broadly accurate. In that context, it's hard to see this as being anything other than a direct attack in response to what they saw as a blasphemous provocation.
Looking at everything that has been said in the last 24 hours and the evidence that seems to be emerging, George, one thing that worries me or makes sort of slight concern is that the Eurozone will suddenly be pressured to come up with a certain reaction or to react a bit too quickly to something that perhaps isn't quite ready to be dealt with yet, insofar as people are saying that there is a connection to Syria, there is a connection to Iraq, these men are jihadis who are highly trained. And yet we might find France reacting, clamping down too quickly in terms of legislation. The United Kingdom has already had that kind of panic in the last few months.
Well, the first thing to be said is that if there are going to be any reactions in any direction, they're likely to be at national level, not further up, not at EU or Eurozone level. This is governments seem to me to be perfectly clear in their own minds that that's central to their core responsibilities of protecting people. And they will, well, you can see some changes coming, can't you? If you are the head of the policemen's union in France, you are going to be asking for better armed and protected policemen very soon. After all, three have died in the last 24 hours, not necessarily in connected incidents, but and they are. So that's one thing you can see coming: equipment and protection for French policemen, a very heavy presence on the streets, I would think, for a long time to come. Will there be changes in the law? The way of stopping people either going to, or what they do when they come back from a civil war like Syria, is legally, and not to mention logistically, an incredibly complex problem, as the British government has already found. And I'm sure the French government has been wrestling with exactly the same questions. So there are no particularly easy fixes here. I think that the thing that worries me is not quite what worries you. I think that what we are going to see is some diffuse political effect here across a lot of European countries. We are, after all, talking about a large group of European countries with rising parties of the right. They vary enormously from country to country, but they are, you know, this incident has handed them a huge political gift. There's no other way to put it.
And indeed, we've seen that today with Marine Le Pen seizing the microphone. I mean, to a lesser degree, Nicolas Sarkozy, who you questioned his presence, but Marine Le Pen seizing the opportunity to say that it was completely reprehensible that France, or the French cabinet, has decided to exclude the Front National from a solidarity march on Sunday. Chechen.
Well, I think it was absolutely inevitable that those movements just described would seek to exploit this opportunity. I think that it's occurring not just at a political level, at the level of Le Pen and others, but at a lower level, a more diffuse level as well. And I'm greatly disturbed by the fact that in the last 24 hours, I've seen reports of 6 or 7 different so-called revenge attacks against Muslim communities, grenades thrown into mosques, explosions, shootings. A family has been injured, I think, in a shooting as well. And the climate of tension that produces in reciprocal cycle of animosity is exactly the sort of petri dish in which these vile populists like Le Pen flourish. And of course, her own popularity has been rising steadily in any case.
Yet out of this, you could argue that the calmest voice to emerge has been that of the French people, who have gathered in their vigils and who have been saying, je suis Charlie, nous sommes Charlie. The internet is flooded with images of tolerance, love, the pen certainly being mightier than any kind of gun. It's been quite an astonishing reaction in that respect, hasn't it?
It has, but I'm always wary of extrapolating from the sort of trends we see on Twitter to national political dynamics. It is indeed heartening to see these mass rallies, to see international solidarity. To what extent can such things blunt the political, long-term political effect on right-wing parties? I'm much less confident. I think, less optimistic.
I think you've got to be very careful about reading from the kinds of people who hold candles in large public squares or are on social media. That, by and large, is the educated middle class, and good for them. But the polarization of communities takes place, you know, at a much wider level. Shashank was referring to the episodes of anti-Islamic violence or discrimination which have been going on. Don't forget, this is a polarization which runs in more than one direction. Jewish people are leaving France in unprecedented numbers. And they're not probably leaving, you know, they're probably leaving for a reason. They perceive a threat and a danger. And France had one of the largest Jewish communities in Western Europe.
And to what degree, Shashank, would you say that this so-called polarization of communities has been something that the French have been very late to address? I mean, it was as little as 1995 that there was the bombing in the Paris metro, which was an attempt to bring the Algerian war back onto the French mainland. One need only think of the fact that it was 1994-95 when La Haine, the French movie, came out, which had three main protagonists living in a deprived suburb. One was black, one was Jewish, one was Arab. And it required the French cabinet to go and have a look at it to get an idea of what French society was like.
And of course, since then, we had serious riots, and overlaid above those social tensions has been the unprecedented outflow of European and French Muslims to foreign battlefields in a way that is historically completely without precedent. Yes, I think they have been slow to address it. And yes, there are those corrosive tensions below political level. At the same time, I don't think I'm wary of connecting the incident we saw yesterday to those broader trends. They are plugged in a way. One of the suspects was arrested nearly 10 years ago for attempting to fight in Iraq during the US occupation. He was subsequently convicted to months in prison. He then dropped out, worked in a supermarket for a while. His parents, I think, were of Algerian descent. He himself said he was radicalized at that time by Abu Ghraib. So he swims in those broad currents of disaffection that you describe. But again, this was a very, very specific attack against a very specific target. And I would read it in that context rather than anything overly broad.
Nonetheless, very briefly, we have the culture of laïcité that you have in France, where there is no religion, which is obviously going to alienate some. And you also have the fact that the French immigrants from the likes of Algeria were pushed into the suburbs, out of the cities, and effectively culturally alienated from them in a way that arguably hasn't happened in many other cities across Europe.
Right, but I'm I think there are many pathways to radicalization, and it's not always about cultural marginalization. I think in the UK, it's interesting to draw a comparison. Many of those who have gone to fight in Syria have not been very socioeconomically deprived. I think they've suffered from a sort of dislocation of identity, and that's quite different. So until we know more about these suspects and those who may have supported them, we can't really say whether they are part of that current or they were simply burning with these grievances entirely separately.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with Emma North, joined by George Brock and Shashank Joshi. We'll have more on the hunt for those responsible for yesterday's terrorist attack in Paris when we come back.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1800 hours Tokyo time, 1600 hours London time, 11 a.m. in New York. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me, George Brock, who's Professor of Journalism at City University here in London, and also from the Royal United Services Institute, also in London, the Research Fellow Shashank Joshi. Well, as the events in France have been unfolding, we've seen an awful lot of information coming to light by way of a media outlet called BFM TV and Radio. It would seem many of us hadn't heard of the organisation until recently, but they're clearly very well connected. George, if I may start on you, you see the BFM vans with their little satellite dishes whizzing around Paris. They seem to have taken over French news.
One of the things we're going to see in the digital era a lot of is people just suddenly popping up because they are niche platforms or producers of information, and the news suddenly hits their area and they're very good at it because they've got a, you know, they've drilled deep into a particular subject. Also, new operators operating with new technology, benefiting from digital technology, are much more agile than some of the old ones. So sometimes they're just quicker to it. They're just faster. They've got a better, more flexible business model that allows them to do more. Most of the big events in the next 5 to 10 years, you're going to see something like the little blue and white van zipping around. You're going to find the old performers staggering a bit in the wake of the event.
Can I mention one of those new performers in terms of the Twitter, people using the Twitter platform? Two very important pieces of news or information were broken yesterday that it still took a long time to filter into the mainstream media. One of them was ammunition found at the scene, that the attackers were using Yugoslavian ammunition from 1986. Someone found a shell casing and put it on Twitter. And I haven't seen this mentioned very much. It seems authentic, very interesting. The second aspect is the names of the suspects were first, I think, uploaded to Twitter by a former French intelligence officer, and there's lots of these sort of people floating around. So the reliability here is incredibly up and down. You don't know who's tweeting what, but it certainly is a very important way to keep track of these unfolding events.
But they are certainly, Georgia, a real shake-up of a French television system, which has, it appears to have been static for decades. We've had TF1, we've had France 2 for our news, and we sat down and it was a real appointment to view with the same faces each night. And yet BFM TV is now getting, by all accounts, 10 million viewers every single day, bringing them something that lots of other people have enjoyed for quite a long time, which is lots of live unfolding events.
One of the things it signals is that we've had a lot of disruption of print. Newspapers got whacked by the internet, roughly speaking. What's now going to happen is that terrestrial television is going to get the same thing. And you're beginning to see it there. It's not that difficult to put a television signal over the internet. Okay, as the pipes get better and better and broadband gets broader, it'll get quicker, it'll get faster. That effect can only grow.
In that context, therefore, you were talking about the reliability of information. When you're doing your job as a research fellow following this, how much easier does it make your job?
I think it helps you to triangulate. You also, there are many pitfalls here as well. I've noticed that I think it was NBC yesterday, a very reputable news outlet, of course, who broke the news that one suspect had been arrested. Of course, they had to issue a rather humiliating retraction a little bit later after that, when it turned out this wasn't the one that had been arrested at all. So in a way, even the old media does get it wrong in rather important ways. I think what's really, really useful is you can call upon niche expertise absolutely instantaneously. If you happen to know a former French intelligence officer who understands counterterrorism issues, you can ask him in 1 second what he thinks about the tactics on display and get a public answer. And I think that's invaluable for us.
George?
There are more sources of information, and on the whole, that's going to be better. However, there is one downside which we all have to remember. There's more information in circulation, and it's moving faster. What that means is that you need more people who are going to check it with great care. One of the niche providers that is growing up are people who are verifying stuff. There's an Irish journalist called Mark Little who started something called Storyful, and what they really do is just when there's a big trend, when something big happens, and everybody piles in and says, this is going on, that's happening, they kind of say, what do we actually know here? What are we sure about? And you could see them yesterday afternoon when they thought they were close to an arrest. And, you know, I remember a tweet from Storyful saying, hang on, guys, we're looking at this. We're not absolutely sure this is right. Just wait a minute.
And there's a market for both. I mean, they are self-reinforcing, and one increases the value of the other.
It's in the interaction of the two that you get the gain.
Arguably, you have the old school traditional media who actually come into their own being a little bit slower, but you know that when they say it, hopefully it's right. But I was thinking more, Shashank, in terms of when you're researching terrorism, counter-terrorism, and the way that those engaged in it themselves employ the media. I mean, much has been said about Islamic State using the internet as their driving force. I mean, to what degree are we looking at two men in a Renault Clio tonight heading who knows where, perhaps back to Paris with their Molotov cocktails, thinking, we know that the world's media is trained upon us, and whatever we do, we will get our message out.
Well, there's two channels here. One of them, yes, of course, but that propaganda of the deed has been a feature of terrorism long before new and more swift methods of communication. What is interesting occasionally is when people like that exploit the very information we are looking at. And at Mumbai, that's what happened. The terrorists used real-time social media to recalibrate their attack. In this instance, I think the French police initially, for a lot of yesterday, did an impressive job of keeping tactically relevant information out. And I think actually that was something that a country like India comprehensively failed to achieve 7 years ago.
What is your opinion, and what's your take on the way that the French media has behaved in the last 24 hours? Because this is an enormous story on its doorstep. They haven't had anything like this for a very, very long time, and it has pushed and stretched their news outlets to a new area.
I think they've done rather well, though. I'm rather struck in the last 24 hours by the fact that there have not been paralysing rows about whether or not they should have broadcast a piece of footage. There must be some fairly grim footage, I would think, none of which we've actually seen, thank goodness. I think actually it's not been too bad. Actually, they are operating in it. All established media is operating in an incredibly difficult, disrupted environment. And don't forget, and you were saying there is still a role for established media. One of the things that established media do, irrespective of how fast people are circulating information on social networks or anything else, is supply meaning for things and interpret things. And these are situations where actually the known facts, there aren't necessarily very many of them. So people who have in-depth knowledge, background stuff from the past which they can apply, they're really handy in these kinds of situations. Mainstream media is very good at that.
One of the issues at the heart of this whole tragedy has been the fact that Charlie Hebdo has been targeted several times in the past for the publication of cartoons showing the Prophet Muhammad. To what degree, or you wanted to mention, Shashank, the idea of the German media actually now showing those pictures?
Well, some newspapers absolutely plastering their front and back pages with past covers.
And that is an astonishing thought, because it has therefore to be a decision from within the media to say, OK, are we going to take that step now that there are hundreds of us publishing these images, possibly aggravating the terrorist, you know, to the point where they wouldn't know where to target next?
Well, the editor of The Independent gave a very interesting interview to the Today programme this morning, where he admitted his instinct was to publish, but he felt it too risky to his staff. And one thing he said was that I wasn't certain if others would follow. I didn't want to be the first. There was an element of, well, if this was a collective decision, I may have done it. There's safety in numbers, but I'm not sticking my neck out. Now, there's a separate issue as to, of course, whether it's wise or proper to publish these, whether they're newsworthy or whether they are have no news value and would simply be there for sort of showy and demonstrative purposes. But I think it's interesting. There was a failure of collective judgment rather than just individual judgment here.
George, you wanted to say something?
When the Danish cartoons were the big row, I was one of the editors at the Times who had to decide whether we ran the cartoons during the row. What we in the end did was not run them in print, but we ran them online. And I think at the time that was probably right. But what I sense is we've moved on a long way beyond that. People are now kind of saying in newsrooms, look, we've tried to be polite about this. We've tried to be discreet about it. It's not getting us anywhere. People in Paris are being killed now in unprecedented numbers. And I notice also that new media are much more radical about this. They're much less discreet and they're much less careful.
There's something actually that has been noticed is that, I mean, just looking at the cover of the British newspaper, The Times, it has seconds before the French gendarme is gunned down. The fatal shot is delivered to his head. And that is seconds before point of death. The one thing that the likes of BBC and Al Jazeera have always held back on is showing point of death. But arguments are now being made increasingly that that is possibly something that needs to be shown. Shashank?
I question the news value that it has. Does it serve to illustrate some core point of the story? I think one could also make that same point about the cartoons. I do think one interesting thing is it more offensive to show a supposedly blasphemous image? And of course, by calling it blasphemous, we are taking sides in a theological debate, which when I resent that. Or is it more offensive to show the massacre of a law enforcement officer by a thuggish terrorist who was wounded on the, killing someone lying wounded on the floor? There's a case to be made, of course, that's a severely offensive image. And if we're going to show that, we can damn well show a lot more besides.
Finally, George, the publishers of Charlie Hebdo have said that next Wednesday they will publish, they will write through their tears, they have said. Instead of the traditional 60,000 weekly copies, they will be printing 1 million. What future do you think lies ahead for Charlie Hebdo and the future of satire in France?
Well, let's hope everybody buys a copy and I hope they get a gigantically big sale. I'm sure they will survive. I don't think the tradition of scabrous, insulting drawings, which Charlie Hebdo represents, is going to die out at all, and it shouldn't.
Your opinion, Shashank?
I completely agree, but I hope people understand that by purchasing a copy, they don't need to agree with its content, to sympathise with the thrust of its satire, to make any sort of judgment about the propriety or the values of the magazine. But by doing so, they are supporting the outer limits of free speech, which, of course, is the first line of defence against points of speech much closer to home that we see as more reasonable and safe.
Shashank Joshi and George Brock, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today on Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
Od London, това е Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
There's plenty still ahead in the second half of today's Midori House, including a look at the weeklies in Germany. But before we get started on that, let's get the latest world news now. Here's James.
French anti-terrorism police have converged on an area northeast of Paris after two brothers suspected of being behind an attack on a satirical newspaper were spotted at a petrol station in the region. France's prime minister said he feared the Islamist militants, who killed 12 people, could strike again as a manhunt for the two men widened across the country. Officials in Nigeria say militant Islamists have carried out a second attack on the key northeastern town of Barga. Boko Haram fighters burnt down almost the entire town on Wednesday after running a military base on Saturday. And Nigeria's President Goodluck Jonathan has today opened his campaign to win a second elected term, defending his record on the Boko Haram insurgency and corruption to a rally of thousands in the opposition stronghold of Lagos. And Indonesia's National Search and Rescue Agency says strong underwater currents are making it impossible to confirm whether the flight recorders from AirAsia flight QZ8501 are still in place. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
And my thanks to James Luckhurst for that news update. James will be back at the top of the hour to give us a full roundup of today's world news. And then after that, here on Monocle 24, why not stay tuned for The Urbanist? Your host this week for Monocle's hour dedicated to the cities we live in is, of course, Andrew Tuck. In the meantime, though, welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. This is Emma Nelson. The time in Moscow is 21:35, 18:35 here in London, 16:35 if you're in Rio de Janeiro. It is time to look at what's making news in Germany, to have a look at what's making news in the weeklies, no less, and what place to go other than Germany, and what place to help, person to help us through them all is Imke Hemkel, his Zeit Online's London correspondent. Welcome back to the programme, Imke.
Hello, welcome.
It isn't always a joy to go through the German weeklies because you always know you're going to get something meaty, and, well, actually, there are enough German weeklies for this to be worth our while. Where do you want to start?
It is, again, a very interesting week. I think I start with the Spiegel this time. They have a story that, again, very much stirred the political scene in Germany, but I think also internationally, and certainly also in Britain. And that is dealing with Greece, again, and whether they should leave the euro or not. As you know, there's an election coming up in Greece after the failed attempt to re-elect a president. And the Spiegel now has a story that the German government for the first time considers or thinks seriously about whether they should make Greece go and leave the euro because of fear that the left-wing Syriza will win the election and then will not obey the very strict rules that the Troika in Europe and the IMF are basically and forcing Greece to follow.
Yeah, no exit policy at all designed for any country entering into the Eurozone. Looking at it, though, I mean, you mentioned there the idea that it is perhaps more of a domestic policy issue rather than an issue that benefits the future of the Eurozone in its entirety. There have been, for some months now, quite widespread anti-Greece sentiment. Nothing too unpleasant, just an idea that the Germans are tired of feeling as if they are the ones solely bailing out the Greeks.
You're very polite. I would actually say it was unpleasant. And and I think it, in a way it has been unpleasant from the start because there was this misconception that the industrious, really hardworking Germans paying with their tax for the lazy Greeks. And that was always very wrong because what is the truth is that Greek teachers and nurses pay with a dramatic cut in their wages, pensioners, dramatic cut in their rents and their pensions for German banks. Not only German banks, American international banks, but that is very much a story behind it. And it took the German government a long time to admit that. And I would actually say Merkel should have come out there much, much before. Spiegel actually was quite good in pointing that out. Many other newspapers, including the supposedly serious Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, were not, and were very much on this kind of strict course. What is interesting about this story is that, again, as Merkel has done before, it looks as if she would use one German journalist, Nicolas Blume, who is sort of a problematic figure at the Spiegel. Many editors at the Spiegel don't like him because he comes from the tabloid Bild, and he has a very close connection to the government. And for a second time, it looks as if Merkel and the Merkel government would use Nicolas Blume to bring out a story in the open and have it as a kind of a balloon up there and see how it does. And the Merkel government was actually denying afterwards that they were thinking about it seriously.
Which is surely, given what you've just said about Nicolas Blume, what a good weekly should all be about. It should be driving the next week's agenda in certain ways, pushing forward. You wanted to talk about Stern, which is generally, I find it, a reasonable read. You had other views about this week's. I mean, there is a man. Describe what's on the front cover, yes, and tell me why you don't approve, Imke.
Actually, this week I'm rather hard. I will be rather harsh about this, Stern, because this week it really seems to me a model and a prime example for what is wrong with in some magazine journalism in Germany. They have, again, the story they have of a sexy man and a picture of a female with painted nails, finger pushing up his T-shirt, and he's on a mobile phone. And the story
is, this is a picture of the man that the woman is undressing with her fingers. This is not actually a picture of a woman undressing a man on the front cover of Stern.
Yes.
That would be unprecedented. That would be a departure. They've kept it nice and clean and cool, but you're not impressed by that. It's populism.
It's populism. Moreover, it's a story that it then turns out to be the story about how can you look for a partner, for a love partner on the mobile phone and on the internet. I don't know how often I've read the story. It bores me to death, really.
Is there any new line about what Germans are doing, or is this more just an excuse to have a ripped six pack on the front cover of your magazine?
I very much suspect it's just the excuse you have a six pack on the front of the magazine. It might be hidden somewhere, but I can't find it. And if you look through it, it's lacking of good journalism, and it's probably lacking of staff, of having enough people there who can think of the story. Again, if you go to the Spiegel, they have a fascinating, riveting story from Japan, from a correspondent who's based there for at least a decade, and it describes a phenomenon in modern Japan society that you have over a million of people who are not leaving their room for 10 years, for 5 years, for 10 years, for 15 years, for 20 years, because, as I explained in the story, of the pressures of the society, where you have to function, have to be brilliant in kindergarten, school, at university, and then go into a brilliant job. And they all come from this highly educated families, were supposed to go through this, and just couldn't bear it anymore. And that tells you so much. I mean, it's a fascinating story about Japan, but it also tells you very much about our society. Because part of it seems to be that it really became a problem when Japan went through a recession. We had a similar situation in Europe. So this kind of story you only can do if you have a correspondent in the country who knows the people, who speaks Japanese, and that is what the Spiegel is still paying for. Stern is not, and therefore they have all these boring stories that we have read 20 times before.
Okay, Hemkel, you have made your point. Thank you very much indeed for joining us in the studio. We'll have to leave it there. You're listening to Midori House. Up next, we hear from one of Britain's most respected musicians.
From her perch in Wan Chai, Aisha Spears is Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief. Covering topics ranging from territorial disputes to urban upsets, the luxury goods sector to organic farming, Aisha Spears boasts one of the best beats at Monocle.
From the expanding political influence of Beijing to the growing economic power of Southeast Asia's middle class, we look at the people, businesses and nations that are shaping the exciting Asia-Pacific region.
From Sukhumvit to Orchard Road, Aisha Spears is Monocle's woman in Hong Kong and beyond. Catch her reports and check-ins around the clock right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. The time in Vienna is 1842 here in London. Well, amidst a chorus of Roxy music, ambient sounds and destroying poverty, you might argue Brian Eno is a busy man. But it's all just in a day's work for one of the UK's most respected names in music. And he talked to Monocle's Georgina Godwin about his latest projects.
There are lots of things to be concerned about, but most of them you don't really have any chance of changing them. But I'm always concerned about, more than anything else, the waste of human potential. That's the thing that upsets me, the waste of intelligence. And so much intelligence is wasted from poverty. People who simply don't have the time, the space to use their imaginations. They can't be creative, because to be creative requires that for a little while at least you let go of the basic concerns of staying alive. You can't really be creative if survival is the primary topic on your mind. And so I've been thinking about that for a long time, and thinking, how do we utilize the cumulative intelligence and creativity of people? And recently I heard of an organization called Basic Income UK, who have a very simple idea, and it's rather a beautiful idea, which is give everyone some money every week. No matter how rich they are, how poor they are, just make sure that there's a basic income level beyond which people don't fall. And now, of course, this will be seen as rampant socialism, and perhaps it is, but it's a very good idea, because I think as soon as you can release people from the absolutely grinding poverty that so many people are in, you give them the space to think and the space to actually get themselves out of a bad situation. Most of the time, people who are very poor are just concerned with the next few hours. That's the only option they have. So basic income is a great idea. I like the idea that it says, we believe that all people are potentially creative and that they should be given the chance to express that. You know, because one of the things that's happened over the last 40 years, I suppose, since Thatcherism and Reaganism, is that the inequalities that were starting to dissolve a little bit in the post-war years have really come back with a vengeance. I mean, we have a bigger wealth gap in England now than we ever have done in the past, I think. That's to say, the poorest are furthest away from the richest, further away from the richest than they've ever been. And it's not improving. So we're sort of abandoning a whole echelon of people, really, of saying, well, we don't really need you, but we do really need them. Mm. We need everybody on deck for the next few years, I think.
And creativity shouldn't be a luxury.
Shouldn't be a luxury, yes.
Do you think that music can have an impact on politics? And what's the most political song that you've ever written?
I have an sort of aversion to connecting music and politics directly, in that I don't want to make propaganda. I think propaganda is unfair because it uses the skills that artists have in playing with emotions to actually force people to make decisions that they might not have made otherwise. So I don't really like propagandistic art. Well, that said, of course, I recognize that there are some great propagandistic artists like the Russian Halim Khorshev, whose work is fabulous, but I suppose that that's a kind of propaganda that might slightly be forgiven since Russia was under attack from the Nazis when he painted those pictures. And, you know, they're purely jingoistic Mother Russia type pictures. Well, maybe that was important at that time, but right now I don't want to use music as a way of persuading people to do things that their rational minds ought to be persuading them to do. I'd rather use argument, if you follow. So I don't know that I've ever written a political song, really, at least in the focus sense of politics. I think a lot of what artists do is political incidentally. For instance, the decision by Fela Kuti, as we've been talking about him, to make a band with 15 or 20 musicians is a social decision. It's a political decision. The way that band was run is a political picture as well. The way things happen in the band, the way innovation happened, all of those things are sort of political statements, just like free jazz is a political statement of an idea in politics, sort of notion of benign anarchism or something like that. Mm. So I think artists, by the choices they make in the way they create things, make political statements all the time. But that's different from saying, I believe this and I'm going to persuade you by manipulating your emotions to believe it as well.
Brian, we're almost out of time, and we're almost out of time in 2014. What does 2015 hold for you?
Some ominous things. Well, it does, actually. I mean, we're now starting to see the dark side of the internet, which I think we hadn't done, at least those of us who were sort of influenced by Californians. Californians are wonderful people who believe that the universe is fundamentally exists in their favor, sort of thing, for their benefit. And now they're starting to discover that perhaps it doesn't, as they find out that their social media sites are spying on them and that their governments are spying on them and so on. So I'm kind of pessimistic about the future in that sense, the media future for the next little while. The other pessimism about that is noticing that if you trace back any story that is all over the internet and everyone's talking about, you'll inevitably find out that it originates from one Reuters reporter somewhere. One reporter becomes the source of thousands and thousands and thousands of stories. I'm not saying that those reporters are malicious or anything, but what if they just got it wrong? What if they were looking the wrong way at that moment? Mm. Because of the echo chamber effect of media, we suddenly have these kind of snowballs of bizarre stories that appear, which influence politics. They become the basis upon which policy is made. So that seems to me very dangerous. We're in an echo chamber, and somebody only has to shout fire, and suddenly everything's on fire.
Brian Eno there, talking to Monocle 24's Georgina Godwin. The time in Istanbul is 2049. It is 1949 if you're in Copenhagen, 1849 here in London. In a few moments, we'll be getting the latest from the book world. But first, let's have some music, and we'll stay on the track of Brian Eno. Let's have a song he worked on for the rather magnificent Grace Jones's album in 2008. The album is Hurricane. The track is Well, Well, Well.
Compass Spine Style.
The amazing Grace Jones there from her album 2008, Hurricane. The track was called Well, Well, Well. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Time now for our daily art slot. Today we talk books. I'm delighted to say in the studio is Charmaine Lovegrove, Monocle book reviewer, literary consultant and bringer of good tidings when it comes to books in 2015. Welcome to the studio, Charmaine.
Thanks for having me.
Let us begin slightly backwards. I think you wanted to talk about two new books which are out nowish, mm-hmm. But one book which you really wanted to mention, and it is a book that we have covered before here on Midori House, but is worth a second mention. It's H for Hawk by Helen MacDonald. You said this was a book among books.
Absolutely, and I think looking at non-fiction is always a really important way of sort of ending the year and reflecting upon the journey that one's self journey. And I think Helen MacDonald's book is a tour de force in understanding a journey from overcoming grief of her father's death and training her falcon called Mabel. And, through this story, we really learn about how Mabel's journey in a kind of a thriller kind of way, which I think is quite interesting. And it's sort of touches of Robert McFarlane and, you know, a bit of Ian Sinclair in there as well. And it's really about the sort of the memory and nature and nation and sort of how to reconcile love and life. And so really, really big topics, but really well handled in Helen's hands.
How does she reconcile that? Because in many ways it was considered to be an autobiographical book, given the fact that she had a hawk, her father died, this is her story. Mm-hmm. And yet the subjects that you mentioned there are so huge. How does she successfully ally them?
Well, I feel as though ultimately in the way in which she's able to bring her own sense of understanding of the world, and then seeing the world through the eyes of this creature, this really wild creature, sort of it always brings it back to a very sort of humane point in which the world in which we live in, and the empathy that we should share with others, whether those are whatever the type of creature they are, whether they're humans or animals. And I think that the remembering her father, looking at T.H. White's work, understanding nature through this obsession of working with a hawk, and the nation that we live in, you know, we really understand the British landscape as well through her writing.
So a huge expansive work to sum up 2014, H for Hawk, Helen MacDonald, widely available. Let us begin 2015 with a clean plate. Let us cleanse our palates with a short story courtesy of Edith Perlman, a woman who is, nearly 80 now, and has written hundreds of short stories, and yet only a few years ago she was being touted as an undiscovered great.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it kind of almost reminds you of Paul McCartney just being discovered by Kanye. You know, it's kind of, it brings that back to this idea that these older writers, and I think we're going to see a lot of that this year, sort of older writers really coming and older artists kind of coming to the fore and being picked up by a new generation. And I think in this collection, what we're really seeing with Edith Perlman is undisputable, being compared to Chekhov or Alice Munro or Grace Paley. And, you know, this new collection of 20 short stories really brings to the fore the predicaments of being human. And I think that's kind of the theme for my books this week is the
Edith Perlman's short stories take what form? I mean, a short story can do so much in such a small amount of space. Give us a flavour of what I would find in a copy of Honeydew.
Well, you know, there's a story called The Golden Swan, which transports the reader to a glimpse of a cruise ship, and where there's a lavish buffet and a surprise stowaway. Or the story Tenderfoot, where a widowed pedicurist is searching for love with a new customer, and who is also anguishing over his newly buried trauma. And I think what she does so well is that she has such an assured prose that touches on the poetic. And she really highlights the beauty and grace of the everyday, whilst allowing us to really make, you know, really memorable characters that stay with us for a really long time. And I think that sort of everydayness is what's important.
And we have 10 seconds to mention Ben Lerner.
So Ben Lerner is one of my favourite writers. He, again, is all about the everyday and is not just another New York writer. Eugenides, Franz, and love him. And really, it's about sex, friendship, memory, and what it is to be alive.
Neat enough summary. What's the name of his book?
His book is 10:04.
10:04.
Yes.
Hard enough to say. Thank you very much indeed for bringing us to that. Charmaine Lovegrove, thank you very much indeed for coming into the studio. That's all we have time for today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests Shashank Joshi and George Brock. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Benoit Grogan Avignon, and our studio manager was Bill Lutie. Up next, after the headlines, is The Urbanist. Andrew Tuck will be bringing you an hour's worth of all things city-related. Nancy Durham and Marcus Hippie will be here for the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.